Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 164. I decided I'm going to record this podcast intro while taking my walk. I am visiting my mother in Connecticut, and it's her birthday, and I'm very happy to be here. But while I was out on my front walk, I was like, hey, I got to do my podcast. I got to do my intro. So I was like, well, I do want to take a walk. It's nice cold weather. It's beautiful out here in the country, and that's what I've decided to do. So this podcast is actually another one of my old THU recordings that I did a while back. So some of you know about those because I've had a couple of them come out. I've been saving them for a long time. So this one was recorded back in September. But it's two parts because I did them as part of THU TV. So the first part is with Ludger Plantz, who is a really interesting guy. He does a research group, academic education group in Germany, and we talk a lot about it and what they involved in terms of creativity and technology. Really, really interesting stuff. Filmmaker, he's a documentary filmmaker for years, a bit of a rebel, and really interesting. The second part is three people, and what we're talking about is mostly about creativity tools that we use in VR. So the first person is Kelly Townley, and she is works for Oculus Medium, which is a modeling application that you do inside of VR and on the Oculus. And then the other two people is Sirian Wuss and Mach Kobayashi, and they work for Google Tilt Brush, and Tilt Brush is a very well-known VR application to do painting in VR, three-dimensional painting in a sense. It's really, really fascinating. Anyway, really great stuff. Really, really enjoy it. And that's about it. Only other announcements I have is that I will be at Vertex next week. So if you guys are going there, I would love to see you. Just let me know. And that's about it. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Ludger, thank you so much. And is this your first THU?
Yeah,
it's your first THU. So we were talking a little bit before about some of your work and some of the stuff you've done. But let's go ahead and give the audience a little bit of a history of your background and where that came from and what's led to what you do now.
Okay, well, I came from, we made 48 political documentaries mainly with oppressed groups like American Indian Movement, things like that, for more than 20, 25 years.
Right.
And then I was asked to set up a new university in Karlsruhe, Germany. Combined with a new museum and a technology research center, which is the ZKM, the Center of Art and Media Technology.
Okay.
Where the idea was kind of to research and at the same time teach what artists could do with newest technology.
With the newest technology.
In this time, media theory didn't exist.
Okay.
Yeah, we started in to talk about media, and this time there was film and there was radio, but multimedia didn't exist. Digital didn't exist.
Right. How long ago was this?
It's 25 years ago.
25 years ago is when you started this school.
We called ourselves an electronic Bauhaus, and later we kind of transferred it to a digital Bauhaus.
Wow.
Yeah. So the idea from the very beginning was that we have an exhibition room, a laboratory, and a university at the same time in a huge building, mm-hmm. and this was kind of really a challenge, where you teach something you don't know.
Right.
Yeah, because
there was a fascinating story a little bit about the building. Tell me about that. Tell the audience about that. That building is an interesting concept in itself.
Yeah, well, it was the biggest factory for bullets and grenades for the First and Second World War.
Wow.
And
uh-huh.
It was not bombed by the Allies. Nobody knows why.
Right.
And so it became under an architectural protection program, but nobody wanted to get into this industrial building with such a history.
Right.
And we sought to make change bullets and not swords to plowshare, but bullets to VCRs would be a good idea.
That's amazing. And you guys got that access. And you said it's a huge...
It's huge.
It's huge, right?
Yeah.
How many square meters approximately, do you know?
I don't know, but I think it's double the size, the whole thing here.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so we have exhibition room, we have laboratories,
and you're doing laboratories and stuff. And obviously, because you're researching this newest technology, you're constantly swapping things out and trying new things. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, well, we 8 years ago, we started with the expanded 3D digital cinema laboratory, mm-hmm. where we focused in the beginning on digital 3D.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the things where we thought artists from the very beginning in the cave art, they wanted to kind of narrate in space.
Yeah? Okay.
But the technology didn't allow us normally, so we learned how to frame the world.
Right. Yeah?
And what we wanted to do is kind of open it up again, yeah, into space. Yeah, and we started to develop dramaturgic structures, which we called space-time narrations.
Okay.
So in art history, we had space-time experiences, like mm-hmm. the cave art or the sinister chapels, churches. Yeah, mm-hmm. they are experience.
Yeah.
And we have, since Aristotle, the idea of how to organize time, which we call dramaturgy.
Right.
Yeah. Hitchcock said, film and theater is life without the boring parts. It's how you create tension in time.
Right, yeah? right.
And we started to bring it together and said we have to kind of create a space-time narrative and combine space-time experience with dramaturgic structures.
Right.
And therefore, we had to kind of expand the idea of dramaturgy not only in temporal tension, but also to create vertical tension, horizontal tension, and parallax tension, depth tension.
Okay.
And this led, of course, very quickly to VR.
To VR,
yeah.
Okay.
And one of my best friends here is now a new institute in Dublin. They work on creating the holodeck.
Okay.
So the whole thing is about what I call a spatial turn with newest technology to kind of reorganize artistic approaches to space and time.
To space and time. So obviously you think, obviously, when you're going through and you're expanding your view and et cetera, so you basically create this this environment for a VR creation at this point. Where do you feel that some of the challenges may actually lie in creating VR content in that way, specifically in the role of narrative, how narrative fits into this VR content?
Well, the funny thing is I love it because nothing works in VR and nobody knows nothing. Yeah,
right.
Everybody who tells you that they know something, don't believe that.
Right.
Yeah? We are just starting. We're starting with a couple of problems. Where to put the team?
Right.
Where to put the lightning? You cannot hide the lightning. You cannot hide a team like you do now.
Yes. Oh, this is when you're filming in VR.
When you're filming. Yeah.
Right.
The next thing is, for example, the film language, which took 100 years to kind of develop, was quite easy. When I focus your face, and then I look at the camera guy, my mind blended out the in-betweens.
Right.
Yeah. So I cut from here to there, nobody cares.
The invisible style.
Yeah. Because we already do that.
Right.
Because our mind don't want to process the data in between.
Right.
Yeah. But there is not a single experience in our life where we are in a sphere, in a space, mm-hmm. and then we are in another sphere, in another space.
Right.
Yeah. This is possible in Harry Potter films, but in our real life, we have never this experience.
Right.
So to cut from one environment or one sphere, I like to call it spheres,
right.
to another sphere
right.
is not natural, and you have to find an explication. Yeah?
Right.
The other thing is the presence of the viewer. You are completely in the scene. Yeah.
Yes.
But the scene is not reacting to you. How
so
could it
be? That's the thing that I mentioned about narrative, because narrative is a third-person experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of what seems to happen in VR seems to lend itself to first-person experiences.
Yeah. And there had been films like The Lady in the Lake from Montgomery.
Right.
Yeah, which flopped totally because people didn't like it to have all the time the first-person experience.
Right.
Yeah, so I think we have to come with VR more from, again, to make the journey from the cave experience than to try to translate film language immediately towards VR.
But I love this analogy of the cave, right? So what do you think the caveman did in the cave that allowed it to be an immersive narrative experience?
Well, the first thing is, you had been in such caves?
I've seen some.
Yeah,
yes.
when sometimes you really have to kind of go in like this, like in the birth channel. It's not easy to enter.
Right.
And then they had lights. flickering lights, which already kind of started to move the whole thing.
Right.
And the paintings are not two-dimensional.
Right.
They are paint. They use the cave kind of to see things which are already in the cave, and they paint it out.
Right.
And this, with the flickering lights, already creates a really immersive environment.
Right, right, right.
And I would bet my fortune, which I don't have, on that most of those experiences were combined with hallucinogenic mushrooms.
Sure, yeah.
And this was where the cognitive revolution hit into, because sapien humans
right.
existed millions of years and they did almost nothing. They were, yeah.
Right.
And in with this cave art, they started music, they started, then they made sculptures, and then
right.
they made buildings. It was all three-dimensional. It was
right.
all kind of, humans always knew in this time that we are always inside something.
Right.
We are inside a mother, and then we are inside the something. We are all, we don't know, but we don't know an outside.
Okay.
So the whole kind of philosophy also was into kind of this being inside a space.
Yes, yeah? Yes, yes.
And especially with the monotheist religions and writing, humans started to abstract themselves from being inside. Yeah?
Okay.
If I'm here, but I take this book, the words of this book, more serious
mm-hmm.
than the reality here, then I get into an abstraction, in a two-dimensional abstraction.
Okay.
Yeah. Which helped us a lot to understand things about the world. But the loss was to this big feeling of being inside and connected.
Right.
Yeah. And this is also a thing which I think this we could have to recreate now in art.
Yeah. Right.
This feeling of being inside and connected. And I see another really big chance in,
okay.
and this the first point of view, which is a problematic thing for dramaturgy, but can create an enormous amount of empathy.
Right.
If I'm 50 times in my experience a woman or black, or if I'm a dwarf, or if I'm a giant, or if I'm an animal, mm-hmm. and I really experience the world through another perspective, that. In my opinion, will create empathy.
Right.
And this is a huge opportunity. We have, for example, for drama structure, as it's so complicated, I just give you two examples of drama structures we have kind of worked on.
Right.
One I call the cloister strategy.
The what?
The cloister strategy.
The
when
cloister,
you are in
right.
old monasteries,
yeah,
there are these cloisters where you walk around and there are, let's say, 12 art pieces, sculptures or paintings
yes.
from the life of Christ,
yeah.
which gives you an immediately emotional impact on his suffering in the crucifying or things
sure.
like that. Yeah. But when you walk around the cloister, you always have this kind of art experience. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you walk to the next one, but you fill the gap of the story because you know the story while you walk to the next event.
Okay.
Yeah. Whenever a story is really known,
yep.
you can use in the art this cloister strategy.
Okay.
Another strategy we kind of developed, we kind of stole it from Being John Malkovich.
From who?
From the film Being John Malkovich.
Oh, yeah, Being John Malkovich. Yeah, I love it.
Well, the funny in John Malkovich is that people want to see the world through the eyes of John Malkovich. So we
right.
have a real first person perspective.
Right.
So I call it a porthole strategy. That means you go into We Are and you look through the eyes of a person into a scene, but you don't know who you are.
Ah.
And by how the world reacts to you, you have to figure out if you are a man, a woman, if you are Chinese, if you are black and white, if you are beautiful, if you're what.
Right.
Yeah? And the more information you find out what your identity is, the more information you suck out of the scene. Until you have completed this perspective, and then you can go to a porthole into another perspective of the same scene.
Right.
And you have to play the game all over again until you, for example, you solve a riddle, or you solve a crime, or you find the Holy Grail.
Right.
Yeah. Because whenever you see the situation from different point of views, you get different informations.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think it's brilliant idea. I think that's specifically what I'm looking for. Is I think people are struggling right now by trying to just shoehorn traditional film into VR, and I don't think it necessarily works. You can't do things. You can't do edits as well as, like you said before.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't do a close-up because it's just me being very awkwardly close to you. That's going to be different,
yeah, yeah.
right? But you can have different first-person experiences that would be very interesting to have. So I'm interested in specifically some of those ideas. I love your analogy of the John Malkovich stuff.
Yeah. One thing is I'm working on something, probably the most crazy things I ever did. I call it Curved Events, a Quantum Theory of Drama.
Okay.
Where I try to combine something like Einstein and Eisenstein.
Okay.
Yeah. One of those ideas came up when I kind of observed my own dreams, and I found out that in my dreams there are rules. I really believe that there are rules in dreams, just they are different than our daily perception rules.
Okay.
And then I did a lot of research with quantum theory. And I came up to the idea that probably our dreams are ruled by quantum mechanics laws, while our day-to-day perception is ruled by Newton's laws.
Okay.
But it's not lawless. And we are already every day in three realities. We are in our day perception, we are in our dream perception,
right,
which has different rules. Like in quantum physics, you can change, you can morph, you can be on different places at the same time, like an electron in quantum physics.
Right, of course.
And we are in deep sleep. And we know now from brain scanning that when you are in deep sleep, you don't remember nothing, but there's a lot of brain activity.
Yeah.
So you are do something. You are
somewhere.
You're processing somewhere.
Stuff,
yeah?
Right.
So I think this, when we work with VR, we should kind of search wherever we can to find those new tools to create in art in space.
Right.
And not kind of to think that it's... the closest is 3D film, so we just take the step further.
Right. I think there is a lot of wonderful room for art in VR. I think that's a very, very creative field that people can do. I had a past life as an architect, and so in architecture, VR is just very natural, right? Because it is about space and it's about stuff. So to me, immediately, my interest in VR is environments. My is about spatial experiences. But is there other things that you've been researching that you involved with that goes beyond VR and in different areas that you've been exploring?
Yeah, what we do is a lot of trying to combine technology which are not combined. Well, the law of creativity is just bring ideas together or part of your brain together which had never been connected.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
Right.
So, for example, what we do a lot is also together with a university in Edinburgh. It's a technical university, and they are the most advanced from the university side in 3D laser scanning.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They scan normally cultural heritage sites which are in danger by IS or by nature.
Right.
Yeah. Like, for example, in the Black Hills, the four presidents, they scanned it completely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they have scans for the millimeter, exact for the millimeter.
Right.
So one of the things is, for example, you can scan jungle.
Right.
And use it for animation. So you have the data already.
Right.
Or use it for creating environments for VR.
Right.
Or as you come from an architectural background. Let's scan the city over here. They scan Glasgow and Edinburgh completely by the millimeter.
Right.
Yeah. And then ask the population, how do you want to change your city? And then we put some solar stuff in, we put some vertical gardens in, we put some aqua planning for fish, creating fish things. Yeah. And then everybody could virtually enter the city, his own city.
Okay.
And when they agree that this is what they want to have,
yep,
you say print, because it's exact on the millimeter. You can plan and work on that.
Plan and print on that. Yeah, yeah. That's really, really very interesting. Is there, you mentioned you worked in documentary films for a long time. What kind of documentary films did you work on?
Well, we did mainly political documentaries.
Political documentaries?
Mostly of oppressed people on those planet. We worked with a lot of indigenous people in the U.S. In the Amazon rainforest in Mexico, Guatemala, but also with Kurd, my wife is Kurd, or in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
We were in the first Gulf War. We were on the shitholes of the planet.
Sure.
Yeah. And in this time, when you wanted to change something positively on the planet, you joined a guerrilla and took a gun, or you made media that people became aware of it.
Right.
Nowadays, if you want to change something, you invent a new water desalination system,
yes,
yeah, or a new algorithm,
right,
and you can more effectively do good by that than breaking some glasses with a stone.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I mean, that's what the Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation does, right?
Yeah. So. And one of the things which we are now starting since a year is we going heavily towards artificial intelligence in research to artificial intelligence in art.
Okay.
How artists kind of communicate with artificial intelligence and all the problems which comes by that, by taking away jobs and bots and the possibility of super intelligence. That
sure.
we create something which is more intelligent than us.
Right.
And I think this is one of the most important things to discuss. And a politician doesn't discuss it. Yeah. Silicon Valley is not discussing it. They are making it.
I think they are. They're just not doing it openly.
But I think artists should kind of create the awareness that this is already all happening. It's not... they don't agree. Kurzweil would say in 35 we have super intelligence. Other would say by the end of the century, but everybody agrees that it will happen.
Oh, I think it'll be soon. Deep learning is accelerating so fast at this point that it's really hard to figure
and
out how.
It's also, I found it really interesting. A lot of people say artists are reluctant to technology. Bullshit. I cannot imagine Da Vinci being reluctant to technology.
No, I think you're right.
What is important, I think, for us as artists with technology is first thing, like the philosopher Flusser said, is hack the black box. Yeah, use technology in ways which are not completely intended by the technology itself.
That's what makes the best art.
Yeah. Hack the black box. And the other thing is, I think what artists should really do is start to push and help to develop a technology which is not antagonistic to nature anymore.
Right.
We think because our technologies of the first and the second industrial revolution was hardly antagonistic to nature.
Okay.
So sometimes we have the feeling that technology by itself is antagonistic to nature, which is not.
Right.
Ants, for example, are much more than us, even in biomass.
Right.
And they make a lot of transformation and they leave no pollution.
Yes.
As there's no need that we create pollution. I think this is where arts and technology, when they work together with science, we can really positively change the world and design the future.
But so your interest in technology, did it come from just being a filmmaker? And you had, filmmakers have to know about technology, right? I mean, where did your interest in technology and how did you make the bridge there?
Well, when I was around 1920, I supported indigenous resistance because I wanted to fight technology.
Right.
And I wanted to go back to the tribal world, like here.
Yeah, right. I loved
this lifestyle.
Right.
But then I realized that going back to a tribal lifestyle would cost 6 billion people's lives.
Right.
And who could make such a decision? So I said, well, maybe I have to change course and don't attack technology, but transform technology. And the more I got into that, the more I found out that it's really not technology itself. It's we are just too stupid to create good technology yet.
Okay. Yeah,
but we are on the brink. For example, windmills and solar powers are not perfect, but they're much better than what we had before.
Right.
Yeah. At the moment, sea desalination for solving the problem of climate change and the Sweetwater.
Right.
It's mostly by oil, which is stupid. Yeah, we could do that by wind. We could do it by osmotic process. I think we can create a technology which emancipates and empowers people, and don't enslave them.
And don't enslave them. Yeah. I think that's really nice. Now you mentioned the deep learning as something that you're seeing is going to affect the world in technology and possibly even creatively, because. I think that there is, what's interesting about some of the first demos of deep learning algorithms is surrounded by art in a lot of ways, where people are teaching the computer how to make art.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said it's more of a magic trick in some ways, but the idea that art can be created through technology exclusively, not even involving a person. What do you think about that?
Well, it's quite easy in design, and for example, architectural design.
Sure.
You can give an evolving algorithm, and deep learning a challenge task.
Right.
And they come up with ideas humans cannot never would have never have found.
Right.
And they work perfectly together with the designer.
Right.
For example, in music and painting, what evolving algorithms, algorithm and deep learning could do, pattern recognition.
Yes.
If I show them 500 of my paintings, yep. they find a pattern and they make my paintings. And
yes.
they make, and they can make then thousands of my paintings where I can choose which I want to work on.
Right.
In music, the same thing. Yeah. If you give an algorithm all of Mozart, he can compose Mozart because he finds
right.
a pattern of Mozart style.
Right.
Yeah. Where they are completely are bad at the moment is whatever comes to literature, poetry, literature.
Right.
Because an algorithm cannot understand that I say heart, and I don't mean the organ, I mean love or something like that.
Right.
So whatever, when we talk, when we work with words, it's always the double meaning.
Yeah.
Or yeah, and an algorithm can at a moment not understand any kind of double meaning.
Right.
Yeah. If because it's not a fixed pattern, the same word has very different meaning in different contexts.
Yes.
That will take long for algorithm to understand.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think what we should kind of, especially when it comes to education or working here with the tribe, is mm-hmm. I think sooner or later, algorithms and bots will become better in every kind of answering and resolving tasks.
Which would make things easier.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Takes just longer.
Right.
Yeah. The only, the last stand of us, that I believe, is asking intelligent questions.
Right.
So what we have to train our young people is not to obey and to learn, because that the machine can does much better.
Great.
To create interesting, new, fresh questions.
Right.
Yeah. And
I agree. I think it's fascinating. I love what you're talking about. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I'd love people to know, where can they find out more about your research?
Well, you Google Beyond Festival, and then
sure.
you come next year to my Beyond Festival.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, I think this is the easiest start, and then we are in an interconnected world. If you Google my name, you come to my research, or you visit Karlsruhe and you come to my place and I show you around.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Today, I'm going to talk to some really great people that are talking about tools for creating VR content. And I really want to be able to do this. So why don't I go ahead and have you guys give me your name and what is it that you do real quick?
Sure. My name is Kelly Townley. I'm the executive producer on Oculus Medium.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Kieran Wills, and I'm a software engineer on Tiltbrush.
Hello, my name is Mark Kobayashi, and I'm a software engineer on Tiltbrush as well.
Okay, well, great. So these two tools, Tiltbrush and Medium, are sort of the tools that everyone started to take notice a lot when they were like, the idea of being able to not just see a demo of some content that was done in VR, but actually be able to do something interactive, beyond games, whatever. It was something very creative that came by. What sort of inspired these things? Can you give me a little bit about that? What sort of inspired the idea of creating these tools?
Yeah, I know. So Brian Sharp and Lydia Choi founded Medium, and I think Brian's story is that the first time he got a modern VR headset on, he
uh-huh.
was like, you have to create 3D objects in this, because it's just an instant sort of realization that you get all this stuff for free in VR that you don't get on a 2D screen, you know, operating with a mouse. So you
right.
just tilt your head and you get a sense of proportion and scale almost immediately. So
right.
he was just like, art tools. And he had been doing art tools for a long time for at Bungie, I think, is where he primarily did that. But he's worked with a bunch of game companies. And he just immediately knew that that's what it would be great for.
Sure.
And they made it.
Okay, well, that's great. And so yeah. what about Tiltbrush, too, obviously?
So it's kind of a similar story. There were two people named Patrick Hackett and Drew Skillman. They came from a games background.
Okay.
And they found themselves doing more and more new technology experiments. And as a result, they just started playing around more and more with VR. And they just loved it. So they decided to kind of go off and do their own thing. And they just tried a whole bunch of different experiments in VR. And I think they started with like maybe a chess game or something, multiplayer chess.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then Drew had the idea. It's like, well, what happens if we attach a marker to the end of it? And then he had little trails going around. I was like, oh, this is fun. And then he said, what if we just leave them there? And then he was able to like draw a little house. And then he was like, oh my god, this is the next thing.
Oh, wow,
and
that's
then
brilliant.
That became
yeah.
Tiltbrush.
The story of Tiltbrush, of almost everything in Tiltbrush, is just prototyping and trying stuff
yeah.
out and seeing
right.
what is fun, what
that's,
works.
I mean, isn't that the way most great things get invented? It's just like accidental
yeah.
things
yeah.
that happen, right?
Yeah.
But I think what's fascinating is the idea of creating creating things in VR. But the first thing that comes to mind when I do that is the problem of it's a completely, when you go to a normal program, let's say I'm going to take Photoshop or whatever, because people have been trained to use computers for a long, long time, they have very familiar buttons that they push, right?
Yeah.
Very familiar menus
and
hotkeys, and you know this icon means move, and you know this, and you know where generally where to find it, especially if you use a 3D application, they all kind of look the same. You can't do that in VR because it can't exist in the same screen window, right? So how is it? Tell me a little bit about the challenges and so, how you deal with interface.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head. That is our biggest challenge, like the interface. Because on a PC, you've got the entire keyboard. You've got Control, Shift, all these things that can modify what you're doing.
And years of muscle memory.
And you have a sense of like, okay, this is what this button does. And you have like, you know, 26 letters of the alphabet, all these numbers and the function keys, whatever.
Right.
And then when you're in VR, you're closed off from the rest of the world. You just see, you know, some representation of your hand and the controllers, and maybe four buttons or so that you can use easily.
Right.
And so for Tilt Brush, that's always been the focus. Just how do you make things really accessible? And for us, that means like just throwing a bunch of stuff on the wall, like a bunch of prototypes, and then really distilling down until you get to the bare essence of exactly what it is that you need.
And it's by far the largest part of our development time is just polishing those interfaces and making sure that...
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I think you're right. It's obviously you have to polish it. But it's also a little bit of a moving target, right? Because you have to get feedback from people about what's working and not working and continuously change it. And every time you change it, people are losing their muscle memory.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also like we have a big artist contingent, like professional artists that we just ask for feedback constantly. And you have to have that relationship because, and it has to be people who are willing to experiment with new interfaces and do something totally weird because it's like you don't know how you're going to do something. And it's like, well, what do you think? And then you try a few different things and then they get a new muscle memory, right? Yeah. It's a VR muscle memory. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, it's crucial to talk to those people and keep that open.
Certainly for us, but we also grab people out in the hallway.
Yeah, totally. It doesn't have to be an artist, right?
One of the most educational and yet heartbreaking things is to try out a new feature that you're like totally excited about and works exactly the way you have in your mind.
Uh-huh.
You try it out with the user and then you can't talk to them. You're not supposed to say, like, tell them what to do.
Right.
And they're like, okay, how would you do this? And they're like, I don't know this. And you're like, why can't you see the button? It's blinking. It's
nobody ever notices that. You can like have a thing pointing at your controller and they're like looking over
there. And then a giant sign that comes out in an airplane that says, that button.
I can't even watch those sessions because it's so distracting.
I know, it is.
But it's also important. Those controllers, right?
Yeah,
like the controllers are very, you know, different for people too. And what I think is nice about some of the VR stuff out there, by obviously the Oculus or the Vive or whatever, is they show you a representation of that controller in some way, so that you can kind of see what your fingers are doing. And it's kind of an interesting idea. I love the way that people are thinking about these controllers, and some of them are very... some of them are incredible. Like, you really have the instinct of it, right? If you look at it in the real world, it's like, no way could I take, like, the Oculus controls. Like, no way is this going to make any sense. And the minute you try it on, it's like, how is that so...
It feels right.
Visually, it was like, there's no way it's going to take me years to master this, and you learn it in, like, 3 seconds.
It's amazing when you put someone in VR for the first time, and you hand them the controllers, and they're like, I can see them and just hold them. And
Like, on the flip side, some people have, I don't know if you guys run into this, but some people have a really hard time with avatar hands because it's a little, it's like, those aren't my hands. And so they're looking at them in VR, but they're a representation of your hands, but they don't look like your hands. So it can be, you have to get used to that too. But some people just turn it off.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that's one of the more exciting parts about VR, that everything is so completely new that even incredibly basic questions like, do we show avatar hands or do we not?
Yeah.
Or like, does this do something? And which button does this? Like, none of that's really been mapped out before. And then in the last couple of years, we're starting to see a little bit more firm ideas about what makes sense.
Right.
But there's still a lot of room and for innovation and exciting new things come up every time. So you just throw out something. It's like, well, do we need that thing? Or can we do it like this? And you start getting a sense of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, are you guys sort of borrowing from other ideas of these, you know, because you're trying to do a lot with just a few buttons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to map a lot of things. And I hate to say it, it's kind of a weird analogy, but I think of Stephen Hawking, right? Mm. How he has very little hand movement left, mm-hmm. and yet somehow uses very few controllers yeah. to create complete sentences and create all this thought. And I'm wondering, like, is there parallels that you guys see in terms of how that works? Or do you sort of, every button opens up new things that open up other things? And
so there's definitely a balance. Like, on the one hand, you want efficiency, because you, as a pro, it's like, okay, I want to be able to just map things out and be able to do anything as efficiently as possible. On the other, you have like the accessibility of the product itself. Right. And so you might be able to say, oh, okay, I just hit these three buttons in this way, and then that does this other thing. Right. But if nobody can figure it out, or if nobody learns it, then it's kind of moot. So what we try to do on our side is make the very basic functions like easily accessible. So there's a trigger on both the Rift and the Vive. Right. And so that just does the main function no matter what. Right. But then we try to add in, like we recently added this hotkey. So you push the button and then a menu pops up and then you can quick select to one of your other tools. Okay. So that tends to be a little bit more efficient, but then it's not, it's a sort of an optional thing. And so what we'll try to do is make the easy things obvious and then make the more advanced things a little bit more optional, but still efficient.
I mean, I think, but I mean, back to what I said in the beginning, it's you get so much free with VR, so you don't have to have hotkeys and mouse controls for just like moving your camera or rotating your sculpt or whatever you're working on.
Sure.
You just move your head.
Right.
So you get kind of get some of those buttons back when you're in VR
And some things actually have natural physical interactions, so you don't actually need buttons
for
them.
That's exactly right. You just grab it.
Of course.
Right? You don't have to, you know, have a hotkey. You just reach out and grab it.
Right. Yeah. Like to rotate something, you just rotate.
Yeah.
As opposed to clicking a rotate button and rotate.
Like mousing or,
You're right. I actually didn't think about it that way. Yeah. VR allows you to remove a lot of interfaces that you need because you're not in VR.
That's right.
So that's a fascinating thing. Now, I actually want to talk about the amount of movement that is involved to create something in VR versus the amount of movement that is allowed to do things. Now, the analogy I'm going to talk about is Minority Report. Everyone talked about the Minority Report thing, right? And everyone just said, oh, this is going to be the new interfaces of the future.
Everyone
and then realized
that
like,
people
don't want to move that much, right?
No, you'd be sweating.
So you'd be sweating, right? It's like, and I don't want to break out of sweat if I have to model something either.
So we had, I have a story that's like directly related to this. In the initial version of Tiltbrush, there was no scaling of yourself.
Oh, so you had to move around the whole thing.
Yeah, so there were two things about that. One is you had to move around everywhere to whatever the size of your thing is. The second thing is, whenever you opened up a piece in Tiltbrush, you could see like exactly how far they moved. And so one of the things, like people would come up with tricks to make bigger things, they'd climb up on ladders, use mirrors, and all this other stuff.
So
when you saw something bigger than you could reach, you were like, how did they do that? And then we added like the ability to scale yourself so that you could draw these things. But internally, within the team, we had a little bit of debate about that, because on the one hand, of course, it's going to be like way more convenient and you'll be able to create all these amazing different things. But on the other hand, a little bit, you lose a little bit of that. It's like you see a masterpiece and then you get a little bit closer and you see it was made out of toothpicks.
Right.
And you're like, oh my God, that's even more amazing. Mm-hmm. And so there was a bit of that aspect with the original Tiltbrush. It's like, oh, okay, when you saw a large thing or a small thing, you knew that person had to actually move that far.
This new tool is making it too easy.
And is the tool making it too easy? And in the end, we were like, oh, we just got to do it.
Yeah.
And then we had like, we test a lot with artists and we have artists come in and work with us a lot, which is fantastic. And we noticed like initially they'd be like, you know, this and stuff like that.
Right.
But then after we put this in, then they'd be like, you know, sitting on the couch like this and they'd like, couldn't do this. And then they rotate things and they do that.
Yeah.
And so we felt like maybe it had lost a little bit of that. On the other hand, the artwork that we saw out of that was just phenomenal.
Right.
Like when you could create just these giant landscapes and you could step into it and then you could also then scale it even larger than that.
Right.
Then you felt like an entirely new world opened
up. But isn't that nice in itself, right?
I mean,
the ability to do that, that's another freeing thing that the VR is giving you, because you actually are going to see it at any scale you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's really great. All right, I want to talk a little bit about some of the different industries or things that are going on. Obviously, artists, very clear, but artists is a very broad term, right? There's a lot of things that are going on in art that could involve design or other processes. What can you give me an idea? I know you can't necessarily talk about specifics of different industries that have tried things and have found things
possible. I think this is one of the most powerful things about creating in VR is any industry where you work spatially, like you're removing that screen barrier of what you're trying to do for, like, you've got an extra dimension. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, I can actually put things where they would be. I can see them where they will be. And, like, it's like any industry you can think of can always benefit from that.
Yeah.
I think primarily for things like filmmaking or game level design, where a sense of space makes a much bigger difference. Where if before VR you would have something on your screen, you might model it up in Maya or Max or something, but you're just seeing this sort of 2D image.
Right.
But when you can actually step into that set, you can step into that environment, now you feel like, oh, okay, this is a much different way to view it, and now I get a much deeper sense of being in this building. Like, if I were to see this building on the screen, you know, on the video, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, this looks like a pretty decent room. But actually being in here, it's like, oh, there's actually a long alcove that way, and it dips down quite a bit. It feels much different, and so you get a different impression about where you can place things. You also get a little bit more creative. You stop thinking about it in terms of, like, okay, box here, line here. You start thinking of it as, like, well, this is the volume, this is the space, and this is where I can stretch out, and this is what it might look like from all the different angles.
Right, and I think, obviously, as an example, I used to be an architect back in the day.
Architecture
is a big thing, and actually, it's one of my initiatives was to try to bring a lot more architects to THU this year, and it's been successful. So I'm sure that they'd be interested in finding out more about that. But architecture does have exactly that, right? Mm-hmm. What's funny is I know a lot of the younger technical guys and work in architecture firms or the ArcViz places, they've tried VR and they're like, this is amazing, and they cannot get the old renowned designers to put on the headsets because they just resent it, right? I was like,
I mean, I think that's, I mean, I don't know specifically about architecture, but I think that in general that you have these old school people who are very hands-on with their craft, and it's really hard to make that jump. I mean, some people have that curiosity about new tech and they want to try it, but some people are just like, nope, I want my pen and paper. And I totally get that.
But I think what's interesting about those specific people is not just the pen and paper thing. I mean, some of them are don't like it. I know Frank Gehry hates it, but that's fine. But some people, like, I don't know, and they said, please try it on. I'm not going to ask you to do anything. Just look around. And they do that, and they go, oh, wow. It's like, wait, is that where that door is supposed to be?
Yeah.
And then they immediately find themselves subconsciously going into design decision mode.
Totally.
And they're realizing that what they're seeing is so much more of a representation than they would get from the 2D image, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the design process is really big in that way. Yeah. But do you see people like industrial designers using this as well? Are you getting some of those types of people as well?
A little bit. We get a lot of people that are interested in it. We don't know exactly, you know, what they're using it for internally, but we certainly see a lot of people thinking.
There's a lot of interest, and then a lot of people are thinking, like, well, how do I integrate this into my existing processes and workflow?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that seems really common, actually. Yeah. It's like more of an augment tool, right? Rather than like a complete replacement of anything at this point.
Right. So people are looking at this and then trying to take whatever was created in tilt pressure medium and then exporting that out and rendering it or doing things like that. Yeah. So they're using
we definitely see people exporting from tilt pressure in whatever medium and then doing other things with it, either 3D printing or printing or rendering it in different engines.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, people do use that. That's probably the biggest use of medium right now is exporting as an asset.
So it's basically, I hate to say it, but it's kind of like a replacement of ZBrush in a lot of ways.
I mean, medium for sure. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
right, which is fine. I mean, I think that's an interesting use case for it. But obviously, tilt brush has always had this nice little style to it.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of giving something that had a paint feeling to it, right? Had this idea of painting. But painting in 3D is kind of a very strange
thing. So we've always focused on making it accessible and open because our mission is more about bringing people into VR and showing them how cool it can be. And through creative, you know, uses, then you can make something that is literally your own work.
Right.
And so as a result, we kind of add a lot of brushes that are really fancy. But then we also have much more, like, serious brushes that, you know, fine artists might be used to as well. And then I think the goal is to have a tool that is accessible to everybody but also can be used for serious things. And so, you know, for that, all you need is, like, some rudimentary export system, and then they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, it's never the idea if you're, like, in some professional process that you would do everything in tilt brush.
This is just one part of the pipeline.
Yeah. One part of the pipeline.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and people are always going to use a tool and whatever. You're going to come up with some crazy way to use it that you never would have planned for or designed for, and they're going to do something amazing with it. So it's kind of just like
making
it easy, but also you can do complicated things too, and then just kind of letting it loose and see what
absolutely
people
come that's
up
the
with.
Best thing, but also the scariest thing because it's like
people post stuff all the time. We're like, what? How did you use the lathe in that way? And they're using it to make like perfectly, you know, like wheels and like all these like crazy things. It's just that's great.
Yeah, but I mean, but really that's the thing. You guys are in the middle of this, and where you're really sort of experimenting and reacting to this process and this workflow. Where do you guys see this going from here? I know that maybe it is just sort of reacting towards what people are doing, or do you think there's some bigger images or bigger ideas that can happen from this?
I think VR art in general is just insane exploding. There's so many tools out there. Yeah. I mean, Medium itself has only been out since December. We haven't even been released for a year yet, and Tiltbrush not that much longer, but it's like the number of artists working in these tools just in like 6-8 months is insane.
Really?
And so like if you project that forward to, you know, a year from now, I can't even really imagine.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard actually, because it's just
but
going
so fast. I actually
so
think, you know, I think it's also important to think about the idea of VR art, because I think that the first time I got introduced to that idea was from a friend of mine who was actually at THU several years back, named Kevin Mack.
Oh yeah,
you know Kevin, right? And he did a he's really into fractals and old school
procedural things,
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he creates sort of interactive art pieces that you float through, and he's very trippy, very cool. But just the idea of creating non-form space, or creating something that's, you know, it's free. You don't necessarily have to ground it into anything. That's the other thing that's nice about VR. You guys are creating art that doesn't need gravity.
I think it'll be interesting to see. So right now, because also VR is very new, we're connecting everything to kind of physical paradigms and like trying not to, I guess there's the whole nausea thing and all the rest. But as people get more used to it, I think you're going to start to see some very interesting things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, what do you think that people are gonna sort of use this to author things? Can you guys author things out of this, and you can publish your art in Tiltbrush? You guys can do that. Right?
Yeah. So, as a matter of fact, we're talking on Friday about how you can use Tiltbrush in authoring things.
Let's
thank you
talk
for that.
About that.
Yes. So we originally just had like a drawing app, and you made things, and then you could just view it in Tiltbrush. And we've kind of since then expanded a little bit beyond that. It's like, well, can you view it outside of VR? And so actually, our last release, there was a big push to make things accessible on a website. So now you can publish directly from Tiltbrush to a website. But even before that, we started experimenting with this idea. People would come to us and say, oh, I want this feature in Tiltbrush. Oh, I wanted this feature. Oh, I want to do something like this with that. And so we created this thing called Tiltbrush Toolkit. And what that will let you do is you create some drawing or asset, whatever you want, inside Tiltbrush, and then you export it, and then you can pull it inside Unity and have it look exactly the same way. And so from there, you could create and author anything you want in there.
Oh, okay.
So people have made things like music videos or little video games or interactive experiences.
Right,
or
so you just create
movies.
The content and put it right in there,
exactly.
And it fits
in
there.
Yeah.
So that's your basically Unity creation kit in a sense.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, Medium, sorry, just got to talk about Medium.
Of course
but,
you did.
we don't have a toolkit officially, but like, so Medium's different than Tiltbrush in that it's like volumetric. It's more like modeling.
It's more modeling.
Yeah,
right.
So it's not, it's a little bit different. Like most people don't do experiences in Medium. Like you can do an environment, definitely. Like a level mock-up environment, but you can export it as an OBJ, and you can do whatever you want and put that in Unity. Like it's like this. Yeah. Or you can also do FBX, but like it's this very usable file format that you can export as, and then you can take it into anything you want, like not just Unity, but whatever.
All right. Well, let's talk quickly about how people get access to these tools if they want to try them, right?
Yeah.
So first thing, where is Medium available?
Medium, it's an Oculus tool, so it's available on the Rift. People do use Revive with it, but it's made for Oculus. That's what it's for. It actually comes free it's a free piece of software that if you get
Oh, so if you
Oculus
get Oculus,
Rift,
you get
Medium.
Medium.
Yep,
right.
It's one of the bundled pieces.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it works with the handsets.
Yeah, yeah.
Really
I mean, that's,
well.
I mean... the Vive handsets. I mean, I do. I like them. I'm so used to Rift and the industrial design of those controllers. Just feel so good. Like you put them in your hand and they just feel really good.
Well, great. So people will be able to try it out and be able, like you said, on the Oculus. It's available when you get an Oculus.
That's right. Yeah. It's a bundled app.
Okay, does it come pre-installed or do you have to install
it? You have to install it.
So you just look on the Oculus Store and it's available for free.
It's free, yeah.
Okay,
that's right.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great, I'd really love to do that. What about Tilt Brush? Tilt Brush has been one of the newest or oldest ones to do this,
right?
Yeah,
it was one of the first VR apps out there, and it was bundled, I think, initially
with the Vive.
Okay. So Google is much more platform agnostic. We don't really have a horse in the hardware game.
Right.
So we are available both on Rift and Vive.
Right.
Which do you prefer?
I love both of them.
Such a Google answer.
I was personally involved in the Rift port of Tilt Brush, and I really love those controllers.
They're so good, right? They just feel good. They're perfectly weighted.
But the Vive does have really good tracking, and it comes built in with a 360. And if you have a nice big room setup,
there's nothing quite like just walking around. If you want to build the Michelangelo's David.
So either one. Google supports both. And if you buy a Vive, it's bundled. I believe it's currently bundled with
Vive. I think it is currently bundled, yes.
And then on the Rift, you can purchase it on the Oculus Rift store, the Oculus home.
Okay, great. And well, I'm looking forward to hearing your talk as well.
Thank you.
We're wrapping up real soon, but thanks so much for doing this. Great conversation, and yes, keep creating in VR. All right,
thank
thanks,
you.
Guys.
Thank you.